The Alberta Tar Sands is one of the world's largest industrial developments. Oil production from that region is expected to soon become one of the world's largest sources of oil extraction. The industry is located in the third greatest watershed of North America, the Athabasca River. The federal government recently established a standing committee on environment and sustainable development to look into the water pollution there. And 2 weeks ago, this committee abruptly disbanded, and copies of their report were even shredded. Andrew Nikiforuk is a freelance journalist based in Calgary. He is author of the book Tar Sands, Dirty Oil, and the Future of a Continent. And he also recently published the article, What Those Who Killed the Tar Sands Report Don't Want You to Know. And that was published with the TAI.ca. He is their new writer in residence. Hello, Andrew.
Hello there, Peter.
So the report itself was shredded and not accessible. What did you read?
Well, what I read, I mean, this Standing Committee on the Environment and Sustainable Development held seven different hearings on the whole issue of water and tar sands development. And one of the hearings was held in Calgary, one in Edmonton, one in Fort McMurray. And so there are 300 pages of testimony online. And once CanWest broke the news, I mean, the reporter Mike D'Souza, very good reporter, broke the story that, you know, this committee is never going to issue a report and has even shredded its final report, I decided, okay, what's so damning, what's so compromising that a committee would shred its report? And so I went back to the original testimony and read through more than 300 pages.
Who all testified in that to that committee?
There were an enormous number of people. There were folks from the Canadian Association of Petroleum Producers. There were bureaucrats from the federal government, from Environment Canada, from the Department of Fisheries and Oceans, from Natural Resources Canada. There were a number of environmental groups, such as the Pembina Institute. There were a number of very good scientists, such as David Schindler at the University of Alberta, George Dixon, James Barker at the University of Waterloo, Selma Girard at the University of Alberta. And in addition, there were a number of Aboriginal groups and chiefs who also testified, as well as folks from the Northwest Territories. So a really wide range of folks. Now, I should add, I also testified to this committee, as did Dr. John O'Connor. And you know, the committee went out of its way really to get a wide variety of views and input on what kind of impact the project is having on water and what are the federal government's obligations and responsibilities.
Sorry, just to backtrack, you mentioned that Dr. John O'Connor was he testified. Who is Dr. John O'Connor?
Dr. John O'Connor used to be the physician for the community of Fort Chip, and he's the physician that first raised concerns about the number of rare cancers downstream in that community,
okay,
which is likely a water-related issue.
That really is a broad range of people interviewed. What government bodies are responsible for regulating and monitoring water pollution from the tar sands?
Well, the federal government has a number of responsibilities here, and this is the first thing that everyone admitted to, that under the Canadian Environmental Protection Act, the Species at Risk Act, the Migratory Bird Convention Act, the Fisheries Act, the Navigable Waters Act, the Canadian Environmental Assessment Act, those are just some of the federal legislation that gives the federal government a critical role in the development of the tar sands.
And how did the witnesses who were focusing on the Environment Canada, how did they classify their ability to manage water policy?
Well, they basically said that, you know what, we don't know very much and we haven't done very much. Fred Rona, who's with Environment Canada's Acting Director General for Water Science and Technology, said, you know, we haven't done a fish study up there since 2003, and the one we did find that the pollutants from the tar sands were poisoning fish. But then he said, beyond that, we've actually done no additional in-field studies looking at fish health effects. We had Ian Matheson, Director General for Habitat Management Directorate at Fisheries and Oceans, talking about what, you know, the what they didn't know. He said, I guess we know more than we used to and not as much as we want to. In other words, saying, you know, we haven't really done our due diligence here. We don't have a handle on the kinds of information that we should. Another federal government bureaucrat was Cynthia Wright, acting Assistant Deputy Minister of Environmental Stewardship Branch, who said that, you know what, Environment Canada was not involved in the design of tailings ponds holding 6 billion barrels of toxic fish killing and cancer-making mining waste that cover 170 square kilometers area along the Athabasca River. And she said Environment Canada wasn't involved because the ponds do not contain fish. Although the stuff in them could kill almost all the fish in the Athabasca River, Environment Canada said, well, that's really not our responsibility. So that's what, you know, that's what we heard time and time again from the feds. Natural Resources Canada said, you know what, the groundwater issues in this whole region are extraordinary, they're very important, but we haven't properly mapped the aquifers in the region.
Was the policy regime overlooking water management there always structured in this way?
Well, David Schindler, who's a water ecologist, perhaps one of the world's top water ecologists and professor at the University of Alberta, said, look, he said, you know, about 15 to 20 years ago, the federal government actually played a very active role in the monitoring of pollutants on that river. They actually did a very good job. Then they handed over the responsibility for monitoring to the Alberta government, which in turn handed over much of the responsibility to multi-stakeholder industry groups such as the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program. And as a result, things have gone downhill since then. And there's a lack of transparency. There's an inability to get data. And three federal scientists that even reviewed monitoring by the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program found that, you know, what this group is doing is inadequate. They're changing their monitoring stations, the location of their stations, the timing of their monitoring, and even the chemical pollutants that they're actually studying from year to year. And they said, you know, this is a model for very, very poor monitoring.
And so what did you find in these testimonies that explained how the pollution is actually getting into the Athabasca River?
Well, it's getting into the river in two ways. I mean, both industry and government have always claimed that, look, there's no pollution on the river. What various witnesses testified was, yes, there is pollution in the river, and it's coming from one of two sources. The first source would be leaks and seeps from the tailings ponds. And George Dixon and James Barker at the University of Waterloo mentioned that they knew of at least two to three plumes of stuff leaking from the tailings ponds that could be reaching groundwater that could connect to the Athabasca River. James Barker mentioned one pond in particular that is directly seeping into the Athabasca River, and that's Suncor's Tar Island Dike, or pond number one. And then David Schindler also talked about another source of pollution, and that is from air pollution. There's several upgraders up there, and there's a lot of processing of bitumen going on that creates an enormous amount of nitrogen oxides and sulfur dioxides, as well as particulate matter. And what Schindler has found is that industry is now depositing in the wintertime enormous amounts of bitumen and bitumen particulates on the snow. This stuff then melts in the spring, and you have a pulse of pollutants going into the river that is essentially equivalent to 5,000 to 13,000 barrels oil spill every year on the Athabasca River. And Schindler, when he testified to the committee, didn't quantify the volume, but he later did in an article in the Proceeding of the National Science of Academies, a very prestigious science journal in 2009. So there we have at least two known sources, then, of pollution on the Athabasca River, which are of serious concern.
So these tailings ponds are right beside the river?
The issue is the tailings ponds are located on either side of the Athabasca River. In some cases, the tailings ponds are built over very ancient prehistoric valleys that are full of sediment that are, and these are channels through which an enormous amount of water moves. And these channels can reach into Saskatchewan and as far afield as Manitoba. And what the testimony, what various witnesses suggested is that some of the tailings ponds are leaking into these channels, and we really don't have a clear idea where that those pollutants are going, because we really don't understand these channels very well at all. Now, the ponds are also, we know of one pond in particular that, as I mentioned, pond number one, that has been leaking directly into the Athabasca River and has been for a long, long time.
And so what is the Lower Athabasca River Management Framework?
The Lower Athabasca Management Framework is a framework established by the province of Alberta and the federal government to get a handle on the amount of water being withdrawn from the river on an annual basis for bitumen processing, it's about 2% of the river's flow is being withdrawn every year. And they wanted to get a handle on what those withdrawals meant in terms of the river's ecological integrity and what it meant for fish habitat, particularly in low flow seasons in the winter and in the fall. And what we heard was that this framework is not a very good framework. It's highly controversial. Industry was supposed to come up with the framework. They couldn't reach any agreement on it. Then the province and the feds cobbled one together at the last moment. And what witnesses said is this framework is not adequate, is based on incomplete data, and doesn't properly incorporate the climate change as a major factor that is changing the flow of water in the basin. And in fact, water flows in the basin have dropped by nearly 30% since the 1960s for a variety of reasons, including the drying up of the landscape that has been caused by climate change.
And so this framework, which you say doesn't even incorporate the changing flow of the river over time, is that the default policy for
the framework? That's mm-hmm. one of many defaults in the framework, but the witnesses said, look, that this framework is not adequate at this time. It puts both the river and the industry at risk.
So what kind of testimonies came from industry to justify all this?
Well, strangely enough, I mean, most of the testimony that came from industry lobbyists, such as the Oil Sands Developers Group. And, you know, they basically made the argument that, look, our industry stakeholder group, such as the Regional Aquatic Monitoring Program, has found no leaks. While other witnesses said, look, you know, that program is not worth the paper it's written on. They said that the volume of water they're withdrawing is, you know, not all that much and shouldn't cause too much concern. So, generally speaking, industry wanted to downplay its impact on the region, and they also thought that the level of regulatory oversight was adequate. And that basically was their position. But what witness after witness basically said quite clearly was that regulatory oversight was inadequate, had not kept pace with development, that an important baseline data was missing, and that the federal government had really not exercised its responsibilities or its mandate in the region in a very transparent or proactive manner.
Did these lobbyists draw their arguments from any kind of scientific data?
No, they basically draw they draw some of their arguments from industry stakeholder groups, and these industry stakeholder groups are all problematic because their data is not being publicly shared. We're not sure where all their data comes from. And also there are problems with almost all of the stakeholder groups. Some are so controversial that many Aboriginal groups and environmental groups have withdrawn from the organization. One in particular, the Cumulative Environmental Management Association, you know, I think six different groups have withdrawn from that organization because they're not satisfied with the kind of information this organization is putting forward.
What kind of testimonies were there Aboriginal groups testifying at this committee as well?
Yes, there were many. There were Chief Alan Adams from Fort Chip, Chief Jim Boucher of Fort Mackay, a number of folks from the Northwest Territories, and they all suggested one after another that development was proceeding much too quickly and that the federal government was not upholding its obligations to safeguard the Mackenzie River Basin. Jim Boucher in particular, I think he really summed up what the problem is here. He said, "Oil sands development has proceeded on an ad hoc project-by-project basis within a fiscal and environmental regulatory framework that is seriously out of date, lacking a coherent and overall plan and strategy. There is only an ineffective, reactive, piecemeal approach to environmental issues such as water management." And I, you know, he hit the nail on the head.
Right. You mentioned earlier that the story was originally picked up by CanWest's Mike D'Souza. How has the mainstream media covered the abandonment of the report?
Well, I don't think the mainstream media has really looked at this report much at all. I mean, very few newspapers covered the hearings. I'm the only reporter that's actually gone back and read the testimony and reported on the testimony, but any reporter in Canada could do that. And it's kind of odd that a really important investigation of this project and its impact on water and what the federal responsibilities are can just be killed this way, and without much media oversight and without even taxpayers saying, "What the hell?" You know, hundreds of thousands of dollars were spent on bringing witnesses to Ottawa or wherever to provide important testimony. We elect our parliamentarians, our MPs, not to be partisans, but to represent the people of Canada. And it was really partisan bickering between the Tories and the Liberals and the NDP and the Bloc Québécois. In this case, I think it was largely Tories decided in the end that, look, if we publish a report, the findings will be so damning and that they don't want U.S. customers, oil sands investors, or environmental groups having a report like this that they can quote from. So the Tories in the end decided to, rather than even publish a report with dissenting views or anything like that, which would be the normal practice, they just killed it. And, you know, this is the kind of thing that happens in petro-states. You'd expect it to happen in Venezuela, Nigeria, Saudi Arabia, but not in Canada. You know, but petro-states fear transparency, and that's what this whole thing has been about, really, is that the reason the report got killed is that the federal government realized that its findings did not give this project a clean bill of health, did not demonstrate that Canada has been a responsible energy producer, and therefore they decided to kill it.
Has there been any follow-up to killing that report in the Parliament?
Well, no. I mean, the reason you kill these things in the middle of summer is because everyone is on holiday and doesn't pay a hell of a lot of attention to what Ottawa is doing.
No kidding. For folks listening, how would you recommend for them if they wanted to register their concern with the government?
Well, I think they should. There are probably two people they can talk to. One, they should contact the chair of this committee, James Bazan, or they can contact who's a Tory MP from Manitoba, or they should contact Francis Scarpaleggia, who's the vice chair of this committee. And Scarpaleggia has gone on record saying, look, we should have come out with a report. This is outrageous. So I think really most of the attention should go to James Bazin, who was chair of this committee and who has really said nothing about the fact that his committee killed, you know, a very important report.
Well, thank you so much for joining us and sharing this really important information.
You're very welcome, Peter.
I've been speaking to Andrew Nikiforuk. He is a freelance journalist who recently published the article, What Those Who Killed the Tar Sands Report Don't Want You to Know. He's the Tyee's new writer-in-residence. If you would like to read that article, you can visit thetyee.ca.